Welcome to the Developer Podcast, where we talk about how to make cities worth living in, which often has to do with the spaces between the buildings as much as the buildings themselves. My name is Christine Murray, and I'm the founding editor-in-chief of The Developer and the director of the Festival of Place. Our ambition is to break down silos and bring people together to unpick what makes places that thrive. With new legislation for mandatory biodiversity net gain and sustainable urban drainage on new development sites, the role of the landscape architect has become more necessary than ever. But this field of study has long been critical to the more intelligent use of land in the face of a changing climate. Today I'm talking to Caroline Goula, a landscape designer, horticulturalist, and president-elect of the Landscape Institute, who has worked with the National Trust and several local authorities on strategic projects to improve the environment and the health and well-being of citizens. From reducing the carbon footprint of garden machinery to combating new pests, dealing with stormwater runoff and surface water, and adapting historic landscapes, we talk about what this often misunderstood profession can bring to our places.
Yes, I'm a landscape architect, chartered at the Landscape Institute. I'm also a horticulturist, and I'm currently the president-elect of the Landscape Institute, and also working as a chartered landscape architect as a sort of employee as well as self-employed at the moment.
So one thing I hear a lot is that people don't understand what landscape architects are. You've also mentioned another term there, which is a horticulturalist. Can you tell me a little bit, what's a landscape architect? What's a horticulturalist? And what is the confusion that we have in the profession about this role?
Yes, it's an interesting question, actually, and we probably could spend hours on this. But a horticulturist is mainly a person who knows about plants and how to grow them in gardens and parklands and wider green spaces, and also manages spaces for the beauty of the landscape or for commercial elements. So, for example, vegetable growing, very important, and to really sort of understand how to grow them, whether they're a small seedling to a cutting, right up to becoming a mature perennial plant or annual plant or a tree or a shrub or such. And the skills are quite multifold. And a chartered landscape architect is really a person who has sort of studied design or management or maybe the science of landscape or urban design or parks management and these sort of things. And it's accredited route, which really ensures that the professional standards are really high, and also that we are really good entities to employ by clients, which could be quite diverse, whether they're local authorities or private clients or charities or big institutions or such. And we develop landscapes, whether it's a window box or small garden, right up to your parks, around the corner, play areas, these sort of things, but also highway design or larger infrastructure design, whether it is the HS2 new railway line or power line, and so on. Or we also look after national parks and areas of special landscapes to really sort of be involved in their sort of design and management to benefit really people who enjoy them, but also nature.
So the confusion comes, is it between those two roles, horticulturalist and landscape designer? Is it that people don't understand that in landscape architecture encapsulates urban design?
Yes, I mean, there is definitely, I think, whether one, uses the horticultural world or the landscape design sort of world, people don't know what these professions do and have quite sometimes basic understandings. There's a lot of, teaching and training to do with people to sort of make us more heard and understood in many ways. But fundamentally, they are different in many ways, but there are also overlaps. So horticulturists can at times also, plan a garden and these sort of things, but perhaps not on a large scale and with huge contracts and these sort of things. So a landscape professional really has quite rigorous training, how to, not just dream up a scheme or such, but also to look into feasibility studies, but then also go into detailed design and then implementation and specifying, you know, how you do the what we call soft landscape, anything involved in with plants, but also then the hard landscape, which could be anything from paths and benches, from sculptures to follies and these sort of things. And how to sort of then also, you know, implement it, work with contractors, how to develop all that. And then also being involved in management. So we often write management plans as well and go back from time to time to a project site to look how it actually has, settled in and sort of, you know, the planting has come together. And often clients bring us back to look at and to really make sure that they're doing the right thing and such. So it's quite a long process, but very enjoyable, particularly obviously when it goes well.
So in a way, there's a couple of big pieces of legislation coming in, which you know, perhaps are going to make developers and architects have to really understand what they need their landscape architect for.
Yes, absolutely. So one is obviously is sustainable drainage schemes, which will become sort of more mandatory in early 2024, where most new constructions in England require a SUTS-specific authorization by a so-called SUTS-approved body. And before you actually start constructing anything, so and even at projects where there's no necessarily planning permission required. And it is really important because sustainable drainage is really a much better drainage scheme, which A, benefits nature and wildlife because you create more streams and ponds and pools and these sort of things. But also from a maintenance point of view, they're easier to maintain because you don't bury lots of things in pipe deep underground. So they're easier to clean and maintain and these sort of things. So although they require a bit more space perhaps in the landscape, but if you do good master planning at the start of any project, then actually you can design these systems into schemes and actually create some really wonderful spaces for people also to enjoy and bring a lot of wildlife into, you know, an area.
And of course, they're for a very good reason, which is flood risk, right? So this is
The overriding technical reason is flood control. And with sustainable drainage, you basically keep water which comes from the sky and the roof and from paved surfaces. You keep it on site and only very slowly issue it over the following weeks or such back into the streams and rivers. So you actually delay more water reaching the rivers and therefore obviously flooding, which is obviously really important. So yes, that's obviously their primary role. And also I think, you know, with climate change in mind, you keep more water on site, so more moisture on site, also in the more drier parts of the year, which we are now much more seeing each year.
So people are hearing about the sewage crisis as well as, you know, climate change and flooding issues. So these are all interlinked with
to some extent. I think we do get not so much involved in sewage. That's more architects and specialists sort of work. But of course, there is, you know, the water cycle is totally interlinked, and whatever we do and how we manage our land is so important. So when you have, for example, sustainable drainage, you need to make sure that on your surfaces you don't, you know, suddenly change your car's oil and spillage and these sort of things. You need to be very, very careful to make sure you don't sort of really poison the watercourses, which obviously have life and wildlife around it. So I think we all need to take a little bit more time to really understand all this. And we all know, you know, the whole issue is also with microplastics and such and what we use and don't use and such. So I hope in time we get more guidance and perhaps legislation to make us all be much more kinder to nature and all this, because it is expensive to manage water cycles. And we obviously know that from the water authorities and the water companies and such. So hopefully we can see some major improvements in the future years.
Biodiversity net gain is the other bit of legislation. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Again, it becomes sort of mandatory for certain project sizes and so on. And it is a really a big step forward in some ways, where actually developers, when they build or develop, want to develop new housing or other buildings and such, that they have to calculate that there will be at the end of the development actually what we call biodiversity net gain, so there will be actually more wildlife on site, to make developments actually contribute to a better environment, and which has been, you know, set out by government, obviously, in their sort of nature papers and such, that they want to improve, every sort of habitat and also particularly where people live as well.
So legislation typically comes in because we've been doing something wrong. So what is it that we've been doing, through development or through, major master plans?
It is an interesting question. I think probably in the past, some developers really tried to always to get out of putting, more nature benefiting, aspects into their developments. And also, have tried to do something else instead. And I think this now for the first time really puts nature right at the heart of development and makes it actually a standard, which hopefully most developers will take on as a positive thing. Certainly in the professional world, whether it is the landscape professionals or ecologists or many other professionals I work with and I know are really, positive inclined that this is actually happening. We were obviously saddened by the delay, but we have as an institute worked on a paper on biodiversity net gain, which I think is also available online, which gives more help and sort of support for people involved, whether you're a client, developer or such, or a landscape professional. So we are quite optimistic in that sense at this moment in time, but we have, the proof is in the pudding, as we all know.
The work that you've been doing, I mean, all of these issues are interlinked with climate change, and the work that you've been doing with the National Trust is interesting. Can you talk about the kind of needs of these heritage landscapes and some of the projects that you've been, or processes that you've been changing?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, heritage landscapes are becoming more and more important as people, want to visit green spaces, particularly during the COVID period. It has shown how important green spaces are for people's sort of health and well-being. The Trust, like many other organizations, has seen quite an uplift of visitors, and particularly from more the local areas. And also, in light of the sort of more economic crisis we have at the moment, people have less funds to spend to go, to some extravagant places or such. So people spend more locally in that sense and love visiting heritage gardens or other green spaces. And the Trust itself obviously provides historic landscapes, whether it's gardens or parklands. And these are obviously have also issues in many ways. So we are obviously affected by climate change in lots of different ways. So we see many more pests and diseases coming in. Very significant one is related to box plantings. So you suddenly have the box moss caterpillar coming in and frazzling away the small leaves and leaving sort of a carcass of a shrub or hedge, a low hedge or such. So, which is quite difficult. You can use sort of more environment friendly sort of controls by pheromone traps and these sort of things, but long term with big gardens, it may not be feasible to do. So we may actually have to use as box alternative plants. So there will be changes in that sense. The other issues we have, particularly already can be experienced in the south of England, is that the gardens become very dry. And even, this year we've had, in 2023, we had very hot summers with 5 to 10 days of really high temperatures. We can't water. That is just not feasible. And to some extent, we shouldn't do it unless we have very important plant collections and we do water, which are of sort of botanical or, scientific interest. So we need to look at different plantings, which sort of maybe in areas mimic the historic plantings, which may be used 100 years ago or more. But in other areas, we then also have to say we can't do it like this anymore. And we actually have to find sort of garden designers or other people to design, or as landscape architects and these sort of people to design new schemes, which are perhaps more innovative, but still, you know, very beautiful and enjoyable and also benefit people as much as nature. So, for example, we would use pollinator-rich plantings and such. So there's a lot, you know, lots sort of going on. The other issue is obviously, you know, generally carbon footprint reduction, where we would use more environment-friendly tools and machinery. So instead of using petrol power, going over to more electricity and battery packs. So, you know, there's a lot of different things. We take a huge regards to composting and really make sure that we have adequate space for creating fantastic compost. And then also the other thing which the Trust has been doing for many years, probably more than a decade, is to procure peat-free compost, as it's really huge and long-term contribution and awareness to reduce the carbon footprint. So that takes often longer. Not so many nurseries have yet changed to producing peat-free plants in peat-free compost. But obviously now with the Royal Horticulture Society, as well as the government sort of saying they want change, there is change in the air, and unfortunately it has been delayed by government by a few years now, which is a shame. But I think people more and more get it. And I think all of us professionals, we always ask in all the professional exhibitions whether people grow plants peat-free. And I think the message is now going, you know, is quite clear now. And I think the RHS in the current journal, I think, talk about peat-free planting. So their membership and our membership and others are more and more aware now how important it is to, you know, be also considerate in one's own garden, what you do in terms of benefiting landscape and plants in that sense. Yeah.
When it comes to the electrification of the tools and machinery, what was the biggest, or what are the biggest challenges there? I mean, is there still a gap in the availability or the cost of this machinery?
Yeah, so in terms of machinery, I mean, there's huge strides has been made. I think we are now in sort of several generations on of some of these tools and machineries. I think recent exhibition I've been to Saltix, I was quite pleasantly surprised how many battery operated machines are available nowadays. The issue is obviously how successful are the battery packs, how heavy the equipment is, and, you know, general performance. And also, you know, whether one battery pack can be used for other machines as well or not, and these sort of things. So, but I think it's all going in the right direction. And we're also now seeing the first sort of tractors being electric, and also the first sort of ride-on lawnmowers. But I think often people obviously hesitate to sort of pick up the first generation of these ideas or developed ideas and sort of wait maybe until things have sort of settled in a bit. But we work with some manufacturers closely. They like us to test machinery and things. I wouldn't name them now because that's not really fair. But I think it's really useful. And also we share with our lead horticulturalist always, sort of machinery tips as much as anything. So, yeah, I think it's going in the right direction in many ways. And I think what people also like is that they're often quieter, perhaps, to use the machines than perhaps their former petrol cousins in that sense.
And presumably healthier for the workers as well, if they're going to be exposed.
Yeah, to some extent. Although battery packs can obviously add some weight to it. So, yeah. But, I mean, the normal sort of compliance and good practice guidance obviously applies as well. People need to be careful, obviously, yeah.
So I wanted to talk about these pests you discussed. I mean, the box hedge, I mean, we've all seen the kind of topiary and hedges suffering over recent years. But is there a concern, those are the ones that are here now, is there a concern that more pests are coming? And is there anything that people should be aware of?
Absolutely. And people should think twice bringing anything in from another country. And nowadays, the animal plant health agency from the government is very hot on making sure that people are more considerate. At the National Trust, for example, we have a lot of quarantine areas. So each big garden, and also increasingly now the smaller gardens, we have quarantine areas set aside. So when we bring in nursery materials, particularly from those which have no plant health passport, that we can actually keep them in that sort of fenced off area for, 8 weeks or longer, even in winter, to really look at the plants, to, turn over the leaves and look at the buds and flowers, and also the pot, take the plant out of the pot and look whether there's anything in there, because the economic disaster could be quite big if you bring in something. So, and the risk is obviously high. Yeah. And this is why, like you see, often plant sales are often at the edges of gardens, wherever you go. So plants from elsewhere are not brought through a garden because it could damage the collections. Yeah.
I've never thought about that, about the position.
Yeah. Probably even more to say about all this, but yes, no, absolutely. Mm.
One thing that's hit the headlines quite a bit, and I know people feel very passionate about, are the trees. So large trees being cut down. Obviously, there's the kind of historic issue of Sheffield, but also urban trees. There was the story in Plymouth of large trees being torn down. And there's always the sense that new trees will be planted, but there's also controversy around the rate of the death of these trees. Mm-hmm. And, there's often trees in many of the master plans that people kind of doubt or are suspicious about whether they'll actually survive. Mm-hmm. Whether they're given enough room for root growth. I mean, what in the circles of landscape designers and landscape architects, when you're discussing, these approaches to urban trees and the approach to urban tree management and what needs to happen, what are we getting wrong?
It's a really interesting question, I have to say. I think it's because there's so many people involved, and I think partly some people do not understand that the tree is a living organism, and for it to become a mature tree, trees, we're not talking years or decades, we often talking half a century or even longer before they really reach their sort of really majestic stature, which is obviously fantastic. But on the other hand, trees can also fail, and they can get pests and diseases, and they can be dangerous in areas. And for those who look after, public areas in particular, you need to make sure that people are safe, and if something happens, it is a very serious issue. And obviously nobody wants that to happen either. So I think people need to understand that at times a good tree may have to go because it has failed, often not just one sort of tree health test, but several, and, even some including sort of scientific, probing and such, that at times that needs to happen. And, for me, I have seen the life cycle. I have been involved in tree planting and, looking after trees and shrubs and seeing them grow. But I've also been part of felling, and even, after a storm, we had in 1987 or such, and other times, that there is a life cycle. And I think there's also, the need to replant. And I think what I have learned in my career is really that we need to replant more. Because of, maybe five trees you plant now, one might maybe, if you're lucky, get 250 years. And also we need to thin trees. Often, they're planted too close. So we need to actually make sure they create a good, sort of crown and, look great, and also can actually benefit nature as well, if they have better, sort of canopy structure and so on. I think making people aware that there is a cycle in life, and sometimes things happen. And I find, if a tree has to come down, I would always love to see them being used for something in the area, whether it's for public art or for benches or making things out of it. Because I think that's for, it's a nice give back, or further give back by a tree to, to, you know, the local community. I think what we also need to remind us is that, you know, everybody plants trees to reduce carbon footprint. But, you know, that carbon footprint gain is not gained immediately. You know, it will take 30 or 50 years before the tree actually produces enough, you know, oxygen and all these sort of things and carbon storage to be of that sort of value. And so we need to think, you know, not once or twice, but well, what we do with trees, and if trees come down, also have a master plan in place, you know, with what trees we replace them. And what we see a lot nowadays is that in highways, especially in my sort of council, they plant only small trees. They don't plant anymore the limes or the oaks or the beeches and so on, because they all want to reduce the maintenance. Of course, a bigger tree needs more maintenance, but it is absolutely much more valuable to us as you know, humans on the globe than perhaps, you know, a few little trees. So I think there's a big shift change. And I think also one needs to know that I think a lot of trees get lost, not necessarily in public environments, but actually on private land. And I have seen that in the city of Cambridge, where a lot of infill housing is happening and trees are not protected with tree preservation orders or within a conservation area and so on. And they just get felled left, right, center. And the old arboriculturist at the city council has actually done a sort of aerial survey and has absolutely found that private land is the worst offending areas. And a lot of people taking trees out of their gardens because they don't want to pay for trees and in the environment. And I think we all have to look after things. We all have to spend some of our money as well as our taxes on looking after trees. So, yeah.
I find it interesting, this idea that we're not planting. I mean, we see the plane trees come down, you know, in particular, some of them are quite old in London now. Some of them are in the, you know, perceived to be in the way. And I think it's interesting to say that we're not replanting these trees that will grow to that scale. What is the fear? Is it just the root? Are we afraid of how much space the roots take up?
Yeah, so I mean, sometimes you have the scenario where the tree was there first and then people build housing nearby far too close and didn't build the foundations correctly. And then obviously the tree still grows and then the house suddenly gets cracks and so on. And particularly in sort of clay soils like you have in London and elsewhere. And that is, you know, wrong specification from the developer. I mean, in my view, the tree should not come down because the tree was definitely there first, but legal side might think differently.
And is there a way to build a foundation next to a big tree like that?
Yes, of course. There's regulations and guidance for arboriculturists as well as structural engineers, what foundation you need with what type of tree. So like a little hawthorn or such, you know, might have a much more shallower foundations, whereas if you put a lime tree right next to the house, and that's different. And also what distances away you plant certain trees to a house, and these, you know, there are all these sort of tables around which one can use. But I think in terms of specifying for planting a tree, obviously natural soil is the best, unconstrained, which is well looked after and particularly not compacted, whether it is by vehicles, but also people. So I've seen a lot of, you know, trees in kindergartens where people would come and say, oh, my tree looks really bad and we can't understand why, it's just in our garden. And then you go and you see, and the kids have been basically trampling for day after day, for hours and hours, the soil. And like any organism, a tree also needs to breathe, especially underground. So the tree needs to have oxygen and other things in the ground to live. And if you compact the ground, then obviously that doesn't reach even the roots anymore. So, of course, the tree will suffer. There are sort of better schemes where you can plant street trees and they're sort of plastic cages, which create sort of almost like narrower channels within a streetscape, particularly in the sort of footpaths area. Yeah, I mean, you can squeeze things in life, but they're not necessarily optimal in many ways, because a tree really needs, in my view, roots in 360 degrees around its trunk. But
and
obviously,
what have
that
we known?
Can...
I mean, I know there's been quite a lot of books written and, you know, Netflix series around mycelium and around the role of fungi. And, you know, have we kind of, you know, do we need to catch up in terms of our urban mycelium? How's the urban mycelium doing?
Yeah. So I think as horticulturists and landscape professionals, we know how important soil is. And I always say that soil is actually our true gold in life. It makes life, which gold can't do. And if you look after your soil, then also your life is much better. And I think understanding soils and the ecology and ecosystem within a soil is so important, that it is a living material, really. And if you look after it well, it gives you, you know, good results. Yes, you're talking about mycelium and all these things. So basically the fungi and plant interrelationship. And increasingly, there's more and more evidence that a lot of fungi work in a, what we call a symbiotic relationship with trees. So they actually work in tandem. So the tree might give the fungi some nutrition, and the fungi might give the tree something else in return. And that works really well. We also know that obviously the soil harbors some, what you call it, unfriendly fungi. And if you have, and that was Ted Green, who used to be a tree officer for the Royal Park in Windsor. And he researched a lot, especially oaks and leaf matter and these sort of things. And he always said you need the good fungi to keep off the bad fungi. And also he's, you know, was a very big proponent to put back. So if you have leaf fall each autumn, obviously from these sort of deciduous trees, that you rake a lot of these leaves back under the trees or in the planting beds, so that the earthworms, you know, would sort of take in the leaves into the ground through their tunnels and sort of enrich the soil, and the nutrients go back in the soil, and you more and more establish a really healthy soil, which is rich in what we call organic matter and has earthworms, which then also then again facilitate more aeration or giving oxygen to the soil and also more better drainage. So it's really, yeah, really important really to really understand soils and to actually look after soil. And yeah, as I said, for me, it is really the, you know, the best product we actually have, which makes actually the planet tick and kick and actually supports us as humans as much as anything else, really. So very, very important.
Well, I don't want to forget to ask you about the Landscape Institute. You are the president elect. And yeah. Although I could talk about soil and trees all day, as many people know, I do think it's interesting to consider, you know, what is the role of this professional body? We have these professional bodies, you know, in construction. Mm-hmm. They're all different, and they usually look after, you know, one piece of the team. But, you know, what do you see as the role of the LI? And I guess, you know, what has changed over the years, if anything?
Yeah, so the role of the LI is really, it's an educational sort of charity. It is a professional home for landscape architects, landscape and park managers, landscape planners, urban designers, and many more. And some of us even do all of these or some of these categories in that sense in, you know, our career. So we primarily regulate what we call the landscape profession. So we accredit landscape courses, and it's very rigorous. And we also then take on the chartership, which again, we undertake with volunteer landscape professionals to really make sure the standards are you know, really high. Our mission is really to lead and inspire the profession to deliver for what we call as our charitable objectives are for the benefit of people, place and nature in some ways, and for today's and obviously future sort of generations. So it's not necessarily to serve our members to do this, but our members are obviously absolutely key. So as an institute, we also need to look after our members to be able to do this. So we do lots of different things. We revitalize urban areas or neglected landscapes or creating spaces that benefit us in lots of many ways. And ultimately, our work brings people much, much closer to the environments where they live. And I think the purpose of the institute is really sort of to protect and enhance and to the natural and to built environment for the benefit of the public to some extent, and by also promoting the arts and sciences of landscape architecture, as it's sort of the old phrase is really. And with that, we're trying to, you know, obviously encourage the dissemination of knowledge, whether it's to our landscape professionals, but also to the public, you know, on the wider platform, which we feel that increasingly is important. We also undertake research. And also educate about what we find out, obviously. And then obviously doing a whole qualification, education and competency and things. So, we are nearly 100 years old, I think, which is many people don't know, which is quite an exciting time. And we were given, I think, the Royal Charter in the late 1980s, I think 1987, I think. So, which is great. And as a membership body, we do also what we call continued professional development. So all our chartered landscape professionals need to undertake each year at least 25 hours of further training, which really makes sure that we are constantly upskilling people in the profession. And also within the recent years, we've actually also stipulated that 5 of these 25 hours should be on climate change matters, because we feel that is a really important an important topic and understanding we all need to have. We also have recently sort of done an overhaul of our profession itself and developed a so-called competency framework, which makes landscape professionals more relevant, particularly when the training has been completed, whether it's an apprentice or studying at university, that those graduated professionals are much more fit for practicing, and our landscape practices actually have people they can really use and, to do the work which is required. So, which is actually quite good to do that at times, because often one can derail in the fascination and passion about landscape, getting away from the core needs. So that has been a really great, I think, way either to progress things. And we do lots of work. There's so much we get involved with. I don't even know where to start. So, but does it help?
Well, and I guess one question is, you know, what inspired you to become president?
It's an interesting one. I grew up on a large farm in northern Germany. And I always loved nature, and I was always fascinated. I didn't really watch much television, and I think most people remember it was black and white and was rather boring in a small box. So I spent really most of my time outside in nature. And then eventually I was given a identification book from my godfather in East Germany, actually, which he sent over, was allowed to send over, which had animals and plants from the native area. And I started basically learning plants, cycling with my dog and the book. So I knew all the common names. And then I've done my A-levels and then done an apprenticeship in horticulture at a hardy herbaceous perennial nursery with over 1,800 species and cultivars. So that was quite, a good start. And actually you realize how big the plant world was. And then I did not really want to go to university, and I thought, oh, what can I do? And I just thought I come just for 1 year to Great Britain. And I was absolutely fortunate to be taken on as an international trainee at the Royal Botanic Gardens Kew, and then discovered there was this amazing Kew Diploma course. And to my absolute amazement and with huge competition, I managed to get a place on the course. And that was really an incredible eye-opener in terms of all the varied tutors we have, all excellent in their field, and also the many tutors and botanists who were traveling and coming back from all corners of the world and giving us talks, and who were actually also very kind and generous with their knowledge and sort of tuned into students' queries and questions. It was an absolutely, fantastic thing. And then I was lucky to do scholarships to study landscape architecture at Newcastle University, and also to work at the Botanic Garden in Jerusalem. to really learn much, much more about plants and also more plants in drier environments, which now with climate change obviously helps me tremendously to understand what might work and perhaps not. And it's just, you know, passion for nature, wildlife, and also working for people. So most of my life or professional career, I have spent working more for sort of communities, whether it is for charities or local authorities. And I really enjoy, creating good landscapes for people to enjoy who not necessarily may have a lot of money. And for me, that is, I think, one of the nicest a landscape architect can do. And it's absolutely amazing to see what projects people do nowadays and, you know, the ideas and such to give people really something really special on their doorstep. And that is so, so important.
Of course, that's related not only to your work with the National Trust, but also your work at local authorities. And I wondered whether you might share. I mean, we often hear about the financial pressures that local authorities are under. We often criticize them, too, for, you know, whatever trees they've chopped down or not chopped down. And I think one question would be, you know, what are you seeing? You know, what are the positive stories, you know, the local authorities that are doing interesting and vital work that, you know, you think would be worth sharing?
I think particularly those local authorities who have still landscape teams as part of their officer teams, I think are really important because they keep the long-term memory and skills bank and understanding of all the various areas they look after. A lot of other authorities have sort of basically deleted landscape departments and even parks departments to some extent. And everything is done by external contractors and a lot of knowledge is lost. And in my view, it's also much more costly to procure. So my hat always goes off for people working in local authority landscape departments. Most of them work actually in a sort of business environment. So they actually have to bring in money and account for their time and, you know, are a very valuable, are valuable landscape teams within the authority. Their work is absolutely wide ranging. Key is obviously being providing commentary on planning applications to really make sure there's a consistency and also quality involvement to make sure that any developer or applicant is actually proposing, you know, quality work and it's not bamboozling maybe a planning officer who might not know what plant names mean or all these things and can maybe not always interpret a landscape plan. So really, really important. And also working in tandem with other colleagues, whether it's the tree officers or the ecologists or the highway officer or cycling officers and these sort of things. I think local authorities also are under huge financial pressures, which we have seen all over the country. Some have obviously gone over the line and are unfortunately bankrupt and some are close to it. And most of them are near to it, I would say, almost. Apart from maybe a few, you know, larger metropolitan councils, perhaps. I have seen also, you know, councils doing with very little money, still achieving incredible work. And one is actually one I sort of pointed out as part of the this year's or 2023 Landscape Institute Awards, which the president can always choose the final award of all the category winners. And I had a look at all the different ones. It was very, very difficult. But at the end, I choose to present the award to the Bradford Metropolitan District Council and with their landscape leader, Dr. Sayyara Shah. The team has actually made a lot of use of research which was undertaken in the area by universities and NHS and such to work out the communities which were deprived in green space but also had huge health problems. And they linked that together and prioritized their work and developed schemes with the community. And some of them, not necessarily very expensive, but made sure that the community was going to or is using the green spaces much, much more. And as we all know, particularly if children are not outside playing and in playgrounds or, you know, playing ball games in the ages sort of between you know, one and three or four, that has huge life-changing, or what you call it, repercussions in long-term life, because they will never, in adulthood, also, what you call it, walk or play or do sports in a way. So it's really important to get children out into the green spaces, and also provide, you know, a nice landscape for people to enjoy if they have no money to go anywhere else and such. So really important. So, and the award was really given also because it was a team effort in that sense. And they had lovely sort of iterations working also with the doctor who could then, you know, who said, prescribing for nature is one of the best prescriptions you almost can give, sort of in a way. So, and really recognizing that prescribing for health, which is now more and more happening, also in the NHS, is so important. My only problem with that is, you know, yes, the doctors can prescribe, you should, you know, take in part in healthy walks or activities. But I have not yet worked out how actually the people who manage and looked after green spaces get extra funding to do this sort of work with people on the ground. So, so we need to realize that green spaces are costly to look after, cannot always be done with volunteers, and you need to have some income to look after them. And yeah, so it's really important, the green space work. And it's part of my sort of volunteering work. I also volunteer as a Green Flag Awards judge. And it is absolutely delightful to see different gardens and parklands to apply for the award and showcase what they're trying to do. Yeah, but most of them have very little money. It's quite astonishing. And people need to understand, yeah, as I said before, green spaces, you know, need contributions to make sure they're well looked after. And that's, you know, for people as much as for nature. You can't just leave things, you know, you need to manage land. And 99% of the British landscapes are managed by humans. So they're actually not natural landscapes. They're more what we call semi-natural, and very few landscapes, maybe Scotland, the Highlands, where the wind prunes and the trees and keeps them contained. That's where you don't need human interventions. But everything else, when you think of grassland or meadows or gardens and parklands, it's all managed by man.
There is perhaps a perception that if you rewild something, you plant your wildflower garden, you're going to have to maintain it less and it'll just look after itself. Is this a myth?
Yes. It's quite an interesting discussion. Yes, no. I think if you want to keep a meadow, then you need to cut it once a year. Yeah, if you leave it, then you suddenly get the hawthorn seedlings or the birch seedlings coming in. And if you leave it more years, they get bigger and taller. And then suddenly it becomes a woodland and you don't have a meadow anymore. And that's what we call, from an ecological point of view, a succession. So things, you know, one thing succeeds the other, and we call the climax, the end vegetation, is then a woodland.
So that's fine if you want a woodland, but if you don't want a woodland,
exactly, then... Absolutely. And, you know, even with the rewilding, you hear the famous Nepa State, they have cows which do some of the work to keep some clearings and such. And it needs to be quite fine-tuned, this sort of grazing, to make sure you don't get as much as succession plant growth. So you keep enough the coarse grassland, you know, which some of the butterfly and insect species and such need, and birds and so on. And, you know, with meadows, you would have often the meadow bird species and possibly also hedge bird species. And if a woodland is adjacent, also the woodland species going through. But if you have just the woodland at the end, you would only have woodland species and probably different ones you had initially anyway. So, you know, these are different communities. So we need to look after our environments and understand that we need to manage them to gain, you know, maximum wildlife. And even gardening, you know, to some extent is wildlife benefiting. You know, a lot of our garden birds need disturbed soil to get to the earthworm. And if you don't disturb it, you know, then that doesn't happen. Or solitary bees, which live in the ground, need you know, exposed earth. And if you don't, then that's not happening. So, yeah, interesting.
So basically, because we've kind of got a we've got these managed landscapes, we've got a biodiversity loss already, these, you know, keystone interactions between species are not happening. And so we need to go in and make those things happen to kind of,
My personal view, I think just leaving it, I don't think would necessarily get it. To a certain extent, things would enrich, but then comes a tilting point where I think the species diversity would be then in decline. But I'm not what you call a professional ecologist. I've studied a little bit ecology. So I'm looking forward to maybe hear what other people think. So, yeah.
Yeah, but I think really fascinating discussion. I mean, I just want to thank you for being here and going through all of these amazing interlinked conversations here. I have one last question, which is it's two questions in a way. So what do you wish we would plant more of, and what do you wish that we would stop designing into master plans?
Obviously, plants and nature and trees, I think we all need to have more, and we need to be aware that that is important. I especially love green roofs. I grew up in northern Germany, you know, when 30 years or longer, green roofs were, you know, standard almost in many ways. I think there's huge opportunities to make more space of the roofscape, whether it's for water harvesting, for green roofs, or energy generation. Master planning, most importantly, I think we need master planning or spatial plans often. People sometimes design too much in detail without really understanding the wider context. It has, whether it is a historic garden or parkland to, you know, a larger neighborhood or other things, actually doing good master planning actually can create more beautiful landscapes, but also more functional landscapes as well, which are also then easier to look after. I think what we should do much more with master planning is also to bring in local communities or communities which are becoming the new local communities. I find sometimes a sort of prepared spatial plan and development plan before somebody moves into a neighborhood is sort of slightly weird. I think we also need, if you talk about master planning, we need a proper large-scale master planning or land use master planning around city or larger infrastructure, whether it is electricity pylons and pipelines to, you know, gas pipelines and these sort of things, but also land use in terms of you know, urban expansions, because often we, in this country, we develop land which is actually much better, for agriculture and food production, or for the environment and wildlife. And we build on those pieces of land when we should actually build on other pieces which are less valuable. And often we don't plan in infrastructure, whether it is bus or rail or cycleways enough, and actually really be much more sustainable and have master plans which are really highly environment friendly and based on good sustainable principles, and obviously more and more with climate change in mind, and how we can actually through good design reduce all that, not just, you know, by orientating houses in the right location in the right way so you have, you know, the north facades sheltered by planting, so you have less cold facades and walls, to, you know, having the right orientation to integrate solar panels. And I don't see it often enough. Often you see old grid systems used where the solar panels are at their least sort of functional capacity. So we have
some more intelligent land use.
More intelligent, I think. We actually have, in a way, the understanding and knowledge and the talents, but I don't think we use the talents well enough. And I strongly feel that we, as a landscape professionals, can very much help in these decision makings. And I would like to see more landscape-led projects and landscapes or developments. And I think, you know, the most famous one we know of is obviously the London Olympics, which was led by two landscape architects and working in obviously close collaboration with architects and engineers and ecologists and so on, to really create a fantastic landscape, which was, you know, strong during the big global event, but also fantastic in its more slightly scaled down setting, but as a major urban park for a regenerated you know, London neighborhood. So yeah, landscape led is probably the other thing. Master plans to, you know, really create high quality spaces, you know, which are, you know, as I said, beautiful and functional for people and nature alike, really.
Thanks so much for talking to me today.
Lovely. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Developer Podcast, produced by Simon Mercer with music by Fortet. If you love what we do, please consider supporting us. Like and subscribe to the podcast, come to a Festival of Place event, buy a copy of our magazine, become a Patreon, or sign up to be an organization member.